You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 424.
Do it. Do it.
Welcome back to Punk News Podcast number 424. This is Features Editor John Gentile. We're getting close to the end of the year, so people are wrapping up their best of lists. We're getting the end of the year podcast ready to go, and news is interesting, perhaps a little slower than usual, but a lot of interesting stories this week. And to talk about interesting stories this week, we are here with reviews writer, news editor, interviewer, and book putter together, Tricky Ricky Frankel. Tricky Ricky, what's happening, man?
You know what? Two really good things have happened to me this week. Just real quick, my book for the book. Just a quick update. I got my cover proof today, which is really cool. You can check that out on my Instagram if you want to. It came out really, really, really well, just as I had hoped it would. And then I gotta tell you, I know it's sort of like the Christmas season, or it's coming up soon. I got C.J. Ramone's new Christmas 7-inch in the mail, and the B-side is his cover of Father Christmas by the Kinks, and it is so good.
That's
he
cool.
He updated that song so perfectly, and he sang it well. The guitar work is awesome. They updated the sound a little bit, just enough, but they stuck to the original just about perfectly, and I've had it on repeat for the last few days. So two good things have happened to me this week, so... Yeah, I'm excited to be here, though.
What label is that on, Ricky? I don't think I even heard of that.
The 7-inch?
Yeah.
That was a lot. It's. I think it might be. I don't know if it's their last one, but that one came out on Fat. We did a small post about it when it was announced. I think a month and a half ago.
Okay.
But it came out. It technically comes out on December 5th.
Okay. Fair enough. And we are also here with contributing editor Adam White, who's been having an existential crisis lately. And I wonder, was Adam White's existential crisis by the fact that I was, when the staff was turning their best of lists, I said, I don't care if your cat's having an existential crisis. If your list is late, it does not post. Adam White, have you been having an existential crisis?
I am never free of, at least four ongoing existential crises. How many? What's more than one crisis?
I guess it'd be crisis. It's Greek, so it's crisis.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm always fretting about something. This is. I know there's best of lists to write. I suppose I should do that. this is like cool show season in my world. It's like every week in December there's something cool. It's everyone's touring. Everyone's doing something. I'm excited. I can't go to half of them because of, stupid December commitments that everyone has, but I'm trying, John.
Well, fair enough, Adam. I thought your contemplation was more detailed and in-depth than that, but I guess not.
Oh, no, it is. I'm sorry. Yes, if you want to actually get into all of my problems, we can certainly start to dwell on them.
That is what we do on the show, Adam, is we talk about news and also we talk about we deal in sophistic scenarios where we're the only person that matters in the universe, and here's how I'm feeling. Me being one of the guilty parties of this philosophy, if you will.
The first part of the podcast is usually Adam's therapy session.
I wouldn't say it's exclusively Adam. I think we're all equally whiners on the Punk News podcast.
Oh, fair.
So
fair.
Adam, how are you
feeling? Okay, I'm down for some therapy here. So I have two questions that have come up in the past week that have my brain spinning. So first of all, last weekend I went up to the Big Smoke, that's what we call Toronto, and I saw the last show on the Dirty Nils Master Volume Tour. Ricky, this is the one that you caught when they were in L.A.
Yes, I caught them in November, and then before that in June this year. So.
Were they
amazing?
They were amazing, and they had, I don't know if they did this on yours or if it was just for the last show, but did they have the giant light set up for you?
I don't think so. I think they were just using house lights.
No, they had like Nil written behind the stage at the back of the stage in these big lighting rigs that they brought in for it. They sold out a venue in Toronto called the Opera House that is a pretty big venue by my standards of what big venues is. Let's see, what's the Opera House capacity? It was the kind of place that, like, I had to take pause when they sold it out because it's pretty big. How much is it? Or it seems big to me. How many does it fit? 950 people, I guess. So in my mind, that's a big venue. And it's the kind of place that, you know, I saw Pill there. I saw Against Me play there when they were, you know, really, really up and coming and really, you know, just starting to be like the buzz band. Like the Opera House is, you know, it's a place you go as like a big non-stadium rock band in Toronto. So to see Nil, you know, sell it out was really cool. And the show was hopping. It was good. But here's what I couldn't figure out. So first of all, this first occurred to me when I was watching one of the openers. So the same openers, or the same band that they've been touring with was with them, I think, than what you saw, Ricky. So they were touring with a band called Dead Soft, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Right. So they're a band from Vancouver that, they were around a few years ago, and then they like shed half their members and put themselves back together with some different personnel. But they recently signed Arts and Crafts, which is the big indie label in Toronto. It's a Broken Social Scenes label, and they have a new EP came out, and they've sort of like, you know, restarted themselves from the ground up. So they were, I suppose they were around before, but they're in my mind like a pretty unknown band. So Dead Soft is playing their set. And they've got this sort of like 90s grungy thing going on. And there's this one guy that is standing right in front. Like, I'm pretty much in front of the stage, but this guy is like right in front of the stage. And he is going off. Like, he is losing his shit for Dead Soft, right? Like, and every note of that song or any other songs, he's got his arm in the air right before the beat happens. He's, you know, he's gesturing along with every movement of one of those tracks. You know, they would start playing a song and he would turn to his bro and just start like shouting the words along with what the band was about to sing and in a really, you know, exaggerated way. Like, this guy was, he was so happy. Like, he was just into it to a degree that I've not seen someone be into anything, let alone fucking Dead Soft, right? Who are fine, but I was not expecting anyone to be going completely nuts for them. Like, this guy was into it, and I'm watching him, and I'm jealous. I'm like, wow, like this guy is having the time of his fucking life. Like, he is into this, and it's amazing to me. And so then Nil comes on, and they were great. The place was hopping. It was completely full. There was, you know, pyrotechnics and lights and explosions and people dancing all over the place and crowd surfing and all this stuff, right? It was just going crazy. And the band was clearly like, you know, they were exuberant and exhausted because they were at the end of their tour and they were just like, you know, hometown crowd, basically, more or less, and just you know, letting all the stresses of the road out. Like, it was a great show. But the one thing that I realized as I'm there is, like, I'm very much enjoying this performance. I know all these songs, but I cannot get out of, like, I can't get out of my own head. Like, I can't be that guy that was watching Dead Soft and just like losing his shit with everything. Like, I'm standing there and I'm watching them and I'm bopping along and I'm singing along and everything, but I'm conscious of me. Like, I'm conscious of the guy standing in front of me and the guy standing behind me and the person whose breath I can feel on my neck, right? I'm conscious of the fact that, you know, I gotta go out and do the rain and catch a streetcar in a little bit and get back to the train. Like, I'm conscious of, you know, what time it is in the evening. And I'm like, well, what is this? Like, why is there a degree of like into it that I am not able to reach? And I don't think it has anything to do with the bands or anything like that. And I wonder if it's just like, do I need to be drunker? Do I need to be like on more drugs? Like, I feel like there's some like plateau of being like fucking into live music that I am like hovering around the bottom layer of, and I'm not achieving. Like, is this a common thing? Like, when you guys go to a show, do you just lose your mind and you're just spaced out and sucked into the moment, or are you still in your head?
So I definitely empathize, because I've been feeling sort of the same way a little bit lately. What I've found is that, you know, at the Dirty Nil show, I wasn't like losing my mind like you. I mean, it's a great time. The show was spectacular. But what was I going, like, the way that guy you said was acting? Not really, no. I find that I only lose my shit like that, like the guy you're talking about in the crowd, when it comes to certain bands. If I'm not doing it, it doesn't mean I'm not having a great time and enjoying the show. But there are just times, like, I'll give you an example. When I saw Dead to Me in February, they were headlining a show here in LA, and I just lost my shit because it was amazing. I was, you know, chicken jumped into the crowd at the last second, during the last song, and I just came in and helped yell into the mic. I never do that. So there are specific bands for me. I promise I can pretty much say, like, tomorrow I'm seeing Nightbirds for the first time in 2 years, so I might be doing it there too. But for shows like, when I saw Lagwagon in Western Addiction, it didn't really happen. Doesn't mean I didn't enjoy the show less, but I think it just might be on just which band it is and how often you've seen them. I know you've seen the Dirty Nil, like, what, a few times. I've seen them three times.
Oh, I mean, I've probably seen that band play more than like at least a dozen times in my life.
Yeah.
They're a known quantity to me because they're local, right? So I mean, I've seen them a whole bunch, but it's not even so much about that. I feel like there's that, and it might just be a geography thing for me, but I don't go to one of these shows and, you know, look, I always feel like there's a certain level of restraint because I always have to be somewhere, right? Like, I've got to go get in my car and go home after this, right? It's not like I can go to one of these shows and just, you know, I don't want to keep bringing this back to substance abuse because I know that's not what it's about, but like, I can't go to one of these shows and have, you know, one too many beers and just, you know, completely lose my mind and then, you know, stumble onto a bus and then end up in a bed, right? That's never the way it works. It's always like, you know, you're going to go there and you're going to have like a totally responsible, reasonable amount of drinks. And then you have to stop because at some point you have to get back to where you live, which is generally for me a different city. And I don't know if that's just it. It's just like the logistics of going to one of these things is I am not going to achieve, you know, complete frenzy euphoria like some of these people. Or if it's just that, like, I'm not 23, and that's just not the way I roll anymore.
Novelty's wearing off.
I don't think so, because like, I go out of my way to attend these things, and I have a great time when I'm there. And the one thing that I always like weigh it against is like, I've never, and like, and this is like, I think this is a true statement. I've never regretted going to anything. Like, I find reasons to not go to shows all the time. But everyone I've gone to, I've never regretted it. Like, I've never walked away and been like, oh, I could have spent an evening doing something else, right? so I don't think it's not interest. I just don't know what it is. I just feel that like there's some people that are like, you know, they're closer to enlightenment on the than I am or something. Like they're at a different level.
Well, you
John,
see,
what do you think?
Performance anxiety is something that happens to men as they reach their mid-30s.
Oh, yeah. I was not trying to loop it into that, you asshole.
No, Adam, here's the deal. I have felt the exact same thing that you're talking. I saw Leftover Crack on Saturday. And it was actually one of the more interesting Leftover Crack shows. I've seen Leftover – well, I've seen Sturgeon in one of his bands, Choking Victim, Leftover Crack, SFH, or – Sturgeon with Crazy in the Brains, probably 15, 16, 17 times. And one of the most fun things for me about Leftover Crack or Sturgeon's band is sometimes they're amazing and sometimes they're terrible. And sometimes they start amazing and wind up terrible. And sometimes they start terrible and wind up amazing. This show was one of the more chaotic ones, which is with like, it was not a better one in where it just came out and did awesome music. There was just chaos all over. Things weren't gone right. When they were hitting it, they were hitting it. When they weren't hitting it, they weren't hitting it. And the show actually kind of ended in disaster that they threw out microphones into the audience. And the audience, like, didn't give the microphones back, and one of them got stolen. So the show just kind of, like, collapsed at the end and just kind of ended. Which, actually, I think, at this point, because I've seen Leftover Crack so many times, that's interesting. It's kind of like the same thing why people love The Replacements, is you really don't know what's going to happen in the Leftover Crack show. But while I was there, I had a lot on my mind, and I can barely remember the show. I didn't drink or anything, of course. I can barely remember the show because the entire show I was thinking about different things. And what it is, Adam, have you ever achieved that level of being totally into it, Adam, where you're just, yeah, have you ever achieved that ever in your entire life?
Oh, like, I have, but like, to me, it was always like looped into one of the social aspects of it. Like,
there you go.
When I was in college, my roommates and I, like, we were huge ska kids. The slackers would come to Guelph all the time. We would go to these shows, and you know, we'd be fucking, you know, skanking the night away, right? Like, we'd be into it and like, you know, dancing and stuff like that. And it may just be because, like, I'm a sad bastard with no friends because I'm old now. But, like, you know, when I go to shows, generally, it's like I go to shows. You know, I'm not going to shows to like have a communal experience with someone who I have like a personal, like, I'm not there with anyone, right? I'm there with myself. I will know people, but, you know, given like the weird realm that I run in, like, you know, I know the sound guy and the guy that owns the club and maybe someone working the bar. Like, I don't know someone who I'm gonna like throw my arm around and start screaming along the lyrics with, you know?
What my take of that is, and I'm pretty sure I'm right, the last time I was like really, really into a show, when I saw Lee Scratch Perry a couple of months ago, just because it was so incredible. Before that, it might have been when I moshed, when I was like moshing like crazy at that tiny show for Shitty Friends, which was like maybe 2 years ago, when I was like just totally into it, totally animalistic, totally into it, because I don't usually mosh. I mean, not that I'm anti, you know, I'm 35, I don't need to be moshing, but when I wanted, you know, I was into it. The point being is this, Adam, and it's a fact of life. The older you get, the more responsibilities you have, the more you have on your mind, the more you need to plan. When you're in high school, dude, Friday night, Saturday night, you know, you can do whatever the hell you want. Maybe you got a part-time job, you know, on the weekend, but that's your greatest responsibility. So you have no burdens. And so when you're having fun, you're having burdens because you literally have not a care in the world, or almost not a care in the world. You know what I mean? Even in college, you're kind of in that bubble. It's like if you go to class, if you study, maybe you got a job, you got nothing else to worry about. But as you get older, as you have a job, you're like, you're at the show, but you know, I got to get this thing done by Tuesday or Wednesday, or I got to deal with this bullshit, you know, I got to be up in time, you know, I got to wake up early, so when the kids get up, I'm there, you know, I got to drive a while, you know what I mean? You have more concerns in your life, so unfortunately, and this is true for everybody, the older you get, kind of the harder it is to relax and truly be in the moment, because you have so many other things that you have to take care of. So I don't think the answer is not giving up on shows. I think the answer is, when you're at a show and you're able to truly appreciate it, really reveling in that moment, you know what I mean? And I think it's a fact of life, as you get older, you have more concerns, and so it's harder for the music. You know, as Bob Marley says, when the music hits you, you feel no pain, but the older you get, the harder the music has to hit you in order for you to feel no pain, because you have so many other things to be concerned about.
Well, see, that seems very true, right? And I wonder if this is giving me maybe a newfound understanding of the appeal of, say, like a weekend festival, especially one that you're going to travel to and just be at, where you genuinely have nowhere to go the next day but the festival, right? Like you're, it sheds a lot of those like logistical concerns, I guess, that are like stacked up in the back of my brain about how, okay, you know, all right, I have to like, when the show is done, I have to go here and be there, and you know, XYZ has to happen for me to get back to my bed, kind of thing. You know, so maybe that may be that's pushing me to like go like, you know, should I look for doing more fests? Like, is that going to help, you know, get me in the same way that they say, if you know, this is a very like white middle class thing to say, but you know, they say that if you're going on a cruise or to like a resort or something like that, that usually takes you like, you know, 3 or 4 days to like get in, you know, to really get into it, like to really unwind from whatever you have going on at home before you're just operating in like, you know, resort mode. And I wonder if this is like some aspect of that.
You should just go to Netherlands, Adam. As soon as you step off that plane, you're in paradise. Netherlands. That's what you should do, Adam. Paradise. I was in paradise for a week.
Sounds like you need to go to punk rock bowling next year.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I think, God, that's fucking tempting.
Let's go, Adam. Let's do it. I seriously might go this year. It'll be a party.
All right. Do you want my second existential question, or are we? Or should we do a show?
Well, are we doing mail?
No, we'll save mail till next week because we're really, you know, we're really Dr. Phil-ed up right now. You know, let's see. Let me see. Yeah, Adam, I do want to discuss this because we've discussed the end of year list. So take it away, because I've got a very response to this as well.
All right, I did. I found a cool tool to play with for doing best of lists this year. So I was looking around, and this is because I'm a computer science person and a math nerd, I guess. I was looking around to figure out like what do I use to help me rank these records? Like I have this ongoing list that I add to
Adam, I'm
throughout the year,
for a second.
And it was at like
Adam, I gotta pause you. You are such a computer programmer that you need a tool to rank your. I don't mean that as an insult. I mean that as an interesting observation of different mentalities. That and I've got other computer programmer friends that would do the exact same thing. That would like, I need a tool so I can accurately rank my things. So please proceed.
Oh yeah, So I like say like from just my LP list, right? There's probably like 50 records on it this year that I'm like these are all records that I like, right? They're all records that if they showed up on some form or another on my list, I could defend that I like them. And of those, say maybe 30 would be contenders for a top 20 list. So I'm like, how am I going to choose between which of these am I going to, you know, because lists are so fucking arbitrary, right? It's like, which one is number 7 versus number 9, like all this kind of crap. And normally the top of my lists are never a problem. Like I could always just suss out by feel what the top 20, what the top 15 is. I have a problem between like 15 and 20, because that's where stuff starts to fall off, right? That's where you start cutting shit. And that's where, if you know, you introduce one more thing, then the record that you snuck onto the bottom because you really wanted to mention it all of a sudden gets bumped. So I'm like, what can I use to help me conceptualize what I think is in what order? And I found some tool. And it was a thing that I guess that someone was offering to help you make a priority list, right? To choose, and basically you went and entered in all of the items that you wanted, or that you wanted to prioritize between. So in this case, I entered in like 30 records, and then it would ask you just like a series of one versus one question, right? Record A versus record B. If you had to pick one, pick, you know, record B versus record D, record D versus record F, and it would run through all of the pairs, which when you're permutating over 30 is a lot, right? But it would run through all the pairs until it said, okay, based on all those individual one versus one competitions that you've done, here's your ranking from 1 to 30. So I did this, and the nice thing is that going through that exercise and you know, doing it on a side screen while I was at work, so maybe not as fully minded as I should have, the list it generated was pretty decent in my mind. The things at the top of the list are exactly what I expected to be there.
And the stuff in the middle bottom was okay. But there was one or two that were kind of kicking around the bottom five that clearly were only there because I felt that they should be in the list. And I do this every year where there's records where I'll look at them and I will say, this is a good record. This feels like an important record. You know, people like this record and they should. I like this record, but it's not one that it's not lighting my fire, John, but I like it. It's good. It's worthy. Right. And I feel that I need to include those because if I'm not, I have like ignoring the zeitgeist, right? Like I'm ignoring the prevailing winds of the time. And I'm struggling with what to do with a few of those. And I mean, I'll throw out the record that I'm rolling around with right now because you know, I'm not going to offend anyone here. But so I'm looking at the Idols record. So there's a record that a UK band called Idols put out called Joy's an Act of Resistance. Now, in the UK, it's a giant record. So anyone that, you know, is listening to this show that is from, you know, anywhere over there is like they're rolling their eyes because it's the most obvious fucking thing. And but within the North American context, it's just another higher profile punk record of no greater profile than say like some band on Fat or Epitaph is really when you want to weigh it against the rest of them. Now I like Joy's an Act of Resistance. I think that I feel that like, you know, I definitely really like a few of the songs that are on there, a few of them a lot more than others. But I keep thinking about like, if I was to walk into a store and I had $20 in my pocket and there's a copy of this Idols record sitting there that I don't own. And next to it, there's a copy of a record from like one of these, you know, some garage band from Edmonton that sounds like the Ramones that, you know, isn't doing anything particularly lauded. They aren't doing anything groundbreaking. I'd probably spend the $20 on the band from Edmonton that sounds like the Ramones. And I'm trying to weigh that reality of how I would actually spend my money versus what I think I should include in this list. Because if I go by Adam the Consumer, I'd much rather have that dumb Ramones core record. But I fully acknowledge that like it's not doing anything that like the genre hasn't seen before. It's not quote unquote one of the best records of the year, I think, by anyone's measures, but it might be one that I listen to more than anything else. But on the other hand, you have this band that is critically lauded that I will acknowledge that, you know, by all the academic ticks or whatever, is a good band, a good punk band, and an important punk record for any number of reasons. But you know what? I'm going to spend my $20 on the dumb Ramones band. So what does that mean? Does that mean that I should or should not include those kinds of bands?
I'll tell you exactly what you should do, because I've got the definitive answer, Adam. So basically, that you're looking at two contrasting, I guess, perspectives. One is the perspective Adam White, the music critic, and that is people, readers, look to Adam White to tell them what's the important records of the year, what has made significant advances, almost like Adam White as a scientist. That is, you know, you look at or Adam White as the analyst, that is, how have trends changed this year? What is influencing what? That's Adam White, the music critic. On the other side, you got Adam White, the person. That is, forget what everyone else thinks. Forget what you're supposed to check out. What is it that Adam White himself enjoys? You know, totally with the blinders on, I guess, if you will. That is, what Adam White is composed of, DNA and experiences. What does Adam White's DNA and his experiences, what does he get the most enjoyment out of with those two factors? And I think that is the second form is the much better list. The first one makes you look cooler, and that's what Pitchfork does, and NPR. They're like, these are the important records of the year. But I know as a reader, and as a critic, well, you know, I'm thinking of myself as a critic, but as a reader, I don't want someone to tell me what are the big trends. Well, actually, as a reader, I want Pitchfork to say what the big trends are and make that the top 10 list, not because I care, but because I want to know what the general, I guess, global perspective, when I say global, I mean the North American music fan base, what are people talking about? What are they discussing? But what I actually want from as a fan, what I want is I want the writer's personal opinion. What does he or she think is great? And that's more interesting for two reasons. A, it kind of cuts through all the bullshit. You know, like people always say, like, oh, this record's so great. You look back 4 years from now, it's all hype. It's not that great. So it cuts through that bullshit to a degree, but also it lets you know about the person writing the list, not just the music in the list, which readers are I know I'm a reader, am generally interested in, because not only that is, when you know about the person that puts together the list, it informs you as to the music in the list and why does that music move such a person. So I think the clear answer is that you should write the list forgetting everyone else, forgetting about what's important. You should write the list as what you think is special and good and thrills you the most, not what, from a scientific or objective standpoint, is the most important or good. Subject, I want total subjectivity, not total objectivity in music top 10 lists.
Yeah, I actually agree with John on this one. I totally get what you're saying about, like, you know, feeling pressured by, like, you know, whatever's in the zeitgeist. But I can tell you, especially from the last and, you know, for this year, especially my list this year, there's going to be some. I mean, first of all, I think a good thing about, because I also had like 32 records that I've had probably that could have gone on my list if you didn't have a limit of 20. My list, as you'll see, is, it'll have a good amount of honorable mentions. So that's a good way to sort of alleviate part of that. But I think I agree with John that this is that's your name on the list. It isn't like some, like, it's not like we all only have one list and everyone's just voting. That's, you know, everyone on the staff is just voting for what they want to be on one main list. It's yours, and it's you know, your personal taste. And I can tell you, like, there are going to be some albums, one or two albums in my honorable mentions that will probably make some other people's, top 20 list. But there are going to be some albums in my list that took those that, you know, no, not a lot of people probably heard of, but they're good. They're under the radar records, and I put them in there instead of the more, you know, popular and more talked about ones. It's your list, so
I feel strange asking for this advice, cool, or reassurance, because, like, this isn't the first time I've been to this rodeo, but like no matter how I try to hedge against it, I end up going and looking at it and going, like, there's, you know, there's that voice in the back of your head that's like, oh, that's, you don't want to ignore that, that's an important one. And I'm like, I kind of do want to ignore it. I keep thinking about, there's a trendy Japanese book right now for, like, cleaning your house called, like, the Kamari method, where they go through, like, you know, how do you declutter, like, say, like, a bookshelf or a clothes closet or anything like that. And there's a principle in the book where you actually take the physical object in your hand and you turn it over a little bit. And if it doesn't bring you joy, and then that's the way it's phrased, like, if it does not bring you joy in that, you know, by handling it, then it is ultimately disposable and you can get rid of it. And I've been trying to think about, like, the, you know, again, like my record store example. If I'm the walk into the record store and I didn't own any of these things, and there was, you know, any random two of them on the shelf, which one would I reach for? And I'm trying to look at it from that perspective. So, all right, you're reassuring me with my thing about this. John, when are lists due?
4 days ago.
Oh, fuck. All right. Someone play a song.
Have I played the Expats yet on the podcast? I know we talked about them last week, but have I played them yet? I'll take that as a no. Okay.
Have you played the AFI song Trash Bat? No.
Fair enough. So I'm going to play the X-Bats. I'm a big fan of the X-Bats. X-Bats are a father and daughter, and they make music that's sometimes sun country, sometimes jangle garage rock, sometimes early punk rock, and I just think they're a great band. The lead singer is a young lady named Inez, and she has a very unique perspective that's kind of demented, very intelligent, kind of, I guess, drugged out, maybe, you know, psychedelic drugged out. So this is X-Bats. They've got a new album now called Ease for X-Bats, but it's also kind of a compilation of their previous two albums, including the one before that, I've Got the Hots from Charlie Watts. And I think, do you guys want to hear punk rock? Do you guys want to hear garage rock? Or do you guys want to hear sun-style country rock? And we are back. So here's the first story. I'm just going to kind of go through the story. This story is crazy. According to New York Times, on Friday, a former Justice Department employee, George Higginbotham, admitted to conspiring to lie to banks about the source of tens of millions of dollars he funneled into the United States from the Malaysian financier Joe Latlo. According to the plea deal, the scheme was meant to lobby the Trump administration to try to end an investigation related to the embezzlement of billions of dollars from a Malaysian state-owned fund, the One Malaysian Development Berhad Fund, also known as 1MDB. According to the papers, the scheme's plan was to help Joe deflect efforts by American authorities to seize assets bought with money Joe was accused of siphoning off the 1MDB fund. In the plea, Higginbotham stated that he and Praz Michael of the Fugees and Elliot Brady, a Los Angeles-based businessman who was a finance vice chairman of Trump's 2016 campaign and inauguration committee, arranged for millions of dollars of Joe Lowe's money to be transferred to a law firm owned by Brody's wife to pay them to try them to end that 1MDB investigation. Allegedly, Mr. Brody traveled to Thailand in May 2017 to meet with Mr. Lowe and Praz, and he indicated that he would sit down with Joe's legal team and figure out a way to get the settlement on 1MDB matters. Here's the kicker. Mr. Brody was supposed to be paid $8 million for his involvement. Originally, it was supposed to be $15 million, but Praz of the Fugees, acting on behalf of Mr. Joe, negotiated the bonus down to $8 million. On top of that, if the scheme worked as planned, Brody was supposed to get $75 million if the investigation was done in 180 days, and $50 million if the investigation was resolved within 365 days. It's unknown what Praz's compensation is, and charges have not been filed against Brody or Praz, but analysts expect charges to be filed against them because this is kind of a heavy-duty thing. A lot to take from here. One of the things is it's really creepy that someone would be willing to pay someone $75 million to end an investigation by the U.S. Not courts, I guess the FBI. That is, there's so much money going around that he's willing to pay someone $75 million to keep money on top of that, which makes you wonder how much money is he keeping on top of that. The second thing is, it's crazy that it's Trump's election committee's financed co-chair, which is insane. The third is, how has Praz gotten himself involved in the situation? I love the idea that Praz is now working for a sketchy and criminal Malaysian businessman, and he's kind of acting as his number one when it comes to brokering deals in order to conspire to influence U.S. politics and U.S. investigations. Adam, how does Praz get involved in any of this?
John, I have no idea. And to look at this from the music angle in particular, at what point did Praz, stop being, at what point did his music career sort of wrap up, right? Like, he probably hasn't been doing anything in, 10 years at least that was, really in the public eye. So, you come out of music and you end up in some weird places, I guess.
I don't know what to say. That was pretty insane. To go from music to international fraud? Is that what we're going with? That's quite the jump. Pretty spicy. Not sure what else to add.
I just think it's crazy that Trump's finance co-chair is involved in this. It's like, it blows one's mind that elections and politics are this corrupt, and that someone's willing to pay someone $75 million just to get a better result on money on top of that. I mean, you would think $75 million would be the pot of gold, but it's the annoyance fee, which is crazy. Man, I don't know if politics is always this corrupt or just the current administration is especially corrupt. I think politics has always been corrupt, but I don't think it's been this corrupt, which is crazy.
I could not comment. I don't know what happens at this level of intrigue in the universe. It is a few steps above what I'm dealing with.
Here's the other thing. You think Praz should be or Brody? You think they should be worried for their physical safety? Because I mean, I'm thinking, if you're spending $75 million to influence U.S. investigations, you're the kind of guy that's got connections beyond financial connections. You know what I mean?
I mean, you probably have several different international and national agencies looking into this at some point. And who knows what other kind of, black market, I guess cartels could be involved. I don't know. This is totally out of the realm of my expertise here. So I'm just kind of spitballing here.
Yeah, John, I'm sorry, man. I don't have a whole ton of relevant opinions on here. You were a few steps above my pay grade.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of happier news, the Specials just released a new track. The track is called, give me one second here. The track is called
Vote for Me.
And it's the first track that features, not Dammers, what's his name? Terry Hall, since Ghost Town, which is after their second album, before their third album. And it actually reminded me of the third album, even though Terry Hall's not on that album. But I thought it was pretty good. Not amazing, but I guess a good return to form, if you will. Does 2019 need the Specials is the question.
I don't know. The biggest sin of this track in my mind is that, I mean, it's perfectly competent. It's fine. It's a little lifeless, but it's not backing up the lack of oomph with some other level of intrigue, right? Like the Specials have a lot of material that was a little bit slower, but it was always sort of backed up by this looming sense of paranoia, right? I'm thinking about Ghost Town and particular, and just the paranoid undercurrent that would drive songs like that. Vote for Me, it doesn't seem to have a whole ton of depth under what it is on its face. And I mean, it's like, it's a fine, you know, it's a fine little ska song and everything, but I don't know if it, I don't know if it justifies the return of the Specials to the scene. Like it doesn't seem like it's voicing something that was missing, you know, like there's probably like plenty of like young kind of politically minded, you know, acts, even within the ska punk genre, that are going to approach the same sort of message with, I guess, like a little more oomph.
Yeah, you know, I was about to say that. I was expecting something a little bit more lively here. Am I wrong? I mean, I'm not the biggest follower of the Specials, but I would agree. I mean, I haven't listened to them in a while, but aren't they like a lot more like upbeat than this usually?
Okay.
With the Specials, I mean, really only the first two albums. Well, that's not true. But the first two albums are like the super energetic one. The third one is the experimental one, which is why this surprised me, because this is kind of more experimental, like the third album. But Jerry Dammers isn't on it, and Terry Hall is. So that's what I was caught surprised. I think from a marketing standpoint, it would have been better if they had just come back with, you know, some super high energy numbers. But you know, I don't think it's embarrassing or anything. I think it's a perfectly fine, you know, album that, you know, they'll go on tour and play a couple of old, the new tracks and then a bunch of new, I mean, the old stuff, and people will dig it. So, you know, I mean, the Specials have that problem in that if they don't do straight up ska, people will be like, well, why is it the Specials? But if they just do straight up ska, people will be like, you guys did it better in 1979, you know, so it's tough to get around that problem. I'm going to do one last story, then I'm going to drop on out and let Ricky and Adam take it from here. The UN, the international list of cultural treasures through the UN has added reggae music to the list. Reggae music is now considered an international cultural treasure, and here's what they said. They said reggae's contribution to international discourse on issues of injustice, resistance, love, and humanity underscores the dynamics of the element as being at once cerebral, socio-political, sensual, and spiritual. Reggae functions as a vehicle for social commentary, cathartic practice, and a means for praising God. And I found this... it's always great when reggae gets, you know, some appreciation. Even though reggae is kind of popular in the UK and it's only vaguely popular in the United States, I feel it's unfairly overlooked compared to other genres. It's certainly one of the lowest selling, well-known genres in the United States. In the UK, it's a little bit more well-known. And probably because it stems from such a tiny country, if you will, and there's a whole lot of implications there. But I guess it begs the question is, reggae is often a music of rebellion or resistance. So is the UN, you know, saying, oh, reggae's great and we appreciate it, is that a salute or is that an absorption into something it shouldn't be absorbed into? And also, I did find it interesting. I think the UN is a secular organization, but they, in their statement, they said reggae is a cathartic practice and a means for praising God, which I thought was interesting, which is core to most reggae, and most reggae is religious in one way or another. Not that every reggae song is a religious song, but almost all reggae artists are they're not atheists, is what I'm saying. I don't know of any atheist reggae, but I know lots of reggae that isn't necessarily religious, but the singer is religious or believer in some context. So I found it interesting that the UN would mention the religious aspect of the music. But then again, I guess if they don't mention the religious aspect of the music, are they being hypocritical? Because that's a huge element of reggae music. Anyway, it's cool. Reggae's great.
I had no idea the UN did this. So I think overall, to answer your question, I think it's just kind of like an international recognition of the genre that's influenced the world. I don't know if that cheapens the rebelliousness of it or anything like that. But I can't imagine everyone feeling bad about being recognized on an international level about this. Right?
Yeah, I mean, it begs the question about what exactly this means, at least as far as how much effort UNESCO has to put into something like this, because in a way this could just be like, you know, it's be like getting the key to the city or it being declared, you know, international Devo Day in Los Angeles or something like that, right? Like at the end of the day, it doesn't actually mean anything, and no one was out, you know, any money or time to go make that kind of declaration. So, you know, it's an honorarium, which is cool. I mean, as far as John's question about, like, is it strange that the UN's recognizing it as something that's, like, overtly religious in that way? I mean, this is, it's not an endorsement by the Security Council or something like that, right? It's UNESCO. Their job is to look at things that are of cultural importance. And, you know, depending on what culture you're looking at, culturally important in a lot of cases means there's a religious aspect to it. So, you know, it seems to fit within like whatever mission statement UNESCO has, which I will admit that I don't know, but you know, I don't think there's a contradiction there. Yeah, is the question about, like, does this take away from the rebelliousness of the genre? Well, I mean, that's the same thing that, you know, everyone else has to grapple with when they get old, right? We talked about that back when London was, you know, celebrating 40 years of punk with all of these events in, you know, in and around the UK, where they had, you know, an official government sanctioned website where you could learn about punk rock and all this stuff. You know, with time comes a, you know, especially with time and when you pass into history, you get, you know, you get reevaluated. It doesn't mean that your fight is necessarily the fight that is on the, you know, on the top of everyone's minds in the way that it was when it was new. And that's just life. I guess you just have to deal with that.
Well, fair enough. I think there's technical issues on my end, so I'm going to drop out and let Ricky and Adam take it from here.
Cool.
All right. Godspeed, John. Fight your internet demons. So I guess we're going to keep going. We have a little bit that we're going to do before we wrap the show up. Ricky, play a song, and then we'll regroup and come back.
Sure. So I've been meaning to play this band for a while. A friend of mine, actually Thomas Woody from Natterers, he showed me this band, and I really, really liked them. And I saw we actually reviewed, someone on the review staff wrote up this album, so I gave it a shot. And it's so, so good. So if you're looking for like a fresh take on like hardcore, there's a band out of Raleigh, North Carolina called No Love. And I believe they released their very first full length this year called Choke on It in March. And that was through Sorry State Records. This thing, it's like 20 minutes. It flies by. And what I like about, what I particularly look for in hardcore is like, is it all... is every song different, and or does it not mesh? Does it every song not mesh together when you're listening to the whole album? Is it just, you know, is it more than just yelling and a few chords like this? And this band really, really hit it out of the park with this record, in my opinion. So I'm going to play the song "Open Mouth" from No Love's album "Choke on It." Enjoy.
Open mouth.
All right, we're back. We had a few quick stories to rifle through before we wrap things up here. So the first thing, we just wanted to kick this thing off, I guess, on a sad note here. So earlier in the week, as of when we recorded this, an iconic New York record store owner passed away. Robert Plotnick, who is better known as Bleecker Bob, had passed away. He ran a store that was Bleecker Bob's Golden Oldies Record Shop, which was in New York's Greenwich Village. And he passed away after years of declining health. He had a stroke in 2001. Now, his shop has existed in various forms since it was established originally in 1967, and it operated all the way through 2013. So this place was, you know, was there and running and going when New York punk, you know, emerged. It was there for that entire entire iconic CBGB scene, you know, before and beyond. Big, you know, big name musicians, people like David Bowie, Robert Plant, Frank Zappa, they were all known to shop there regularly. And there's actually a really good profile that Spin ran about Bob and his shop that you could go search out if you want to see, you know, a little bit more about that institution. And if you want to search that out, look for the Spin article called "Broken Records: The Final Days of Bleecker Bob's Golden Oldies." So you can go there, and there's anecdotes regarding, you know, Joey Ramone's intersections with the shop and everything else. So I mean, not I suppose you don't have too much to add there, but, you know, rest in peace, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I would recommend taking a look at the Spin article. I didn't read the whole thing. I just sort of skimmed it for the podcast. But it looked like kind of quite the place to check out when it was open.
Yeah, so just a couple audio notes for you folks to take away before we get out of your hair here. First, Me First and the Gimme Gimmes, they've released a cover of the holiday. Is it a holiday classic? I'm not sure if it's a holiday classic.
I think I want to say like some starlet like Marilyn Monroe sang it.
All right, we're talking about Santa Baby. It's always struck me as more kitschy than holiday classic, but hey, whatever. So the band has released a big Me First rockin' cover of Santa Baby that you can go find on YouTube or, you know, wherever else you find your digital music these days. I don't think this is showing up on a record, or is this just like a one-off thing?
It was just a one-off single, and I think they did it. I mean, they released it sort of to coincide with the California dates that they recently finished up with Mean Jeans and Dracula's. But yeah, I mean, hopefully this means that they're recording something new at some point. I guess also for the most part, the secret's been out for a while, but Jay Bentley seems to be playing bass with them now, in place of Fat Mike. I don't know if that's true in the studio though.
Yeah. I mean, like even their like press photos and everything no longer has Mike in them. So, yeah. I just imagine that ship has sailed. On the one hand, this is fun. On the other hand, there's nothing that I want less than, punk rock Christmas covers, let me tell you. I mean, I don't want the real Christmas songs either, but just
you mean the Bad Religion thing didn't hold you?
I don't even think I've listened to that. I saw it announced when they announced that Bad Religion Christmas record a while ago. I like everyone else, sort of like cocked an eye and looked at it funny and was like, "What?" But I can't. There is one Christmas song that is punk rock related that anyone should care about, and it's Fairy Tale in New York by the Pogues, and that's it. Like, you could listen to that on repeat and not have to worry about anything else. And I don't know, like, people that are listening to Christmas music actively on days that are not December, say like 24th or 25th, might be sociopaths, and that applies to punk rock Christmas songs or otherwise.
There's now another one. I mean, the Kinks, like I said before, is the Kinks' Father Christmas is phenomenal. It may not be punk, but CJ Ramone's cover of it, he really punks it up. So I'm going to throw that in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know what else you could put in the list. Like, Run DMC's Christmas and Hollis, I guess. But, like, that's all. Like, it's a very short list of stuff that I'm going to tolerate. So, anyways, this is here if you want to go listen to it. If you listen to this more than once, though, I am highly suspect of your goals and motivations. All right, I want to talk about this last story because it turns out it is entirely unremarkable once you get to the end of the paragraph.
Yeah, if we're looking at the same screen and we're talking about the same story, then I would agree.
So okay, on November 26th, NASA landed its InSight Explorer on Mars, and then it started filtering around online that. And this was actually shared by Green Day, that Green Day had now, you know, had been included in this mission because one of the chips on the Explorer, one of the computer chips, had the words Green Day since 1986 etched into it. So Green Day went and they announced and they said, you know, officially landed on Mars, Green Day since 1986. And they were, you know, very, very, very happy about this. The being included in this. And if you leave it there, it seems that, you know, okay, so someone that was working on this project, you know, some engineer, you know, on a microscopic level went and snuck in a little shout out to Green Day on this piece that we've fired off to another planet. And that's a nice honor. But then when you learn how it actually worked here, there was a program at NASA where more than 2.4 million people had their names etched onto said chip.
Oh, I didn't see that part.
Yeah. So it's not like, oh, you know, some super punk rock, you know, astronomics engineer, you know, snuck a little etching onto a microchip about Green Day. There was I don't know how this was run, but presumably you could go onto a website and pay $5 or whatever and be one of the 2.4 million people that had your name written on this chip. So this isn't so much like Green Day's name went to Mars. I think it's more that like a whole bunch of people that participated in this publicity program, including Green Day, had their name sent to Mars.
Oh, because I'm thinking like, I totally overshot this. I'm like, how does one even like plan that out? Who do you talk to about getting your name etched on something for some fucking Mars rover? And of course, like people as powerful and as probably connected as Green Day probably could do it, but like how? And then, well, that's kind of a.
Let's see here. Hold on, I'm on.
Ruins it. It kind of cheapens it, though.
I'm on the NASA website here. okay, let's see. How did NASA collect the names? More than 1.2 million names were submitted on our website over a 1-year period. And then people who went to the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena or the Kennedy Space Center wrote their names on all these pages that were then scanned and reproduced and put on the chips. And yeah, so unless the Martians use this as some sort of kill list, and when the invasion happens, they're just hunting down the folks that are on that list, I don't think this is newsworthy.
I don't know. It's kind of weird. It's like Green Day's big enough for, you know, this small kind of stuff to be newsworthy. And if we didn't post it, people would be like, why didn't you post it? So I don't know. It was sort of a catch-22. This was, okay.
I mean, like to me, it's like, it's of the same importance. Cause some kid walked into the Jet Propulsion Laboratory because he was on a field trip, and he went to this book and he wrote, like, you know, Bill plus Tammy forever, and now that's on a fucking chip that's on Mars too. It doesn't matter. Tammy doesn't like you, Bill. So that's yeah. That's where we're gonna leave it. All right, was there anything else that you wanted to bring anyone's attention to, or should I play a song and we'll get out of here?
Are we ending just after the song?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, I mean, you know, I mentioned that my book, the cover proof came in the mail today, and that was really kind of a big deal for me. So, if you haven't checked it out yet, I'm out of here book.com. And, if you've pre-ordered it, you should have gotten an email from me at this point, just in regards of like where we are. It's at the printers and it should be printing now. And then once I get them, they'll be shipping out. But if you want to see what the actual cover is going to look like in the back and everything, it's on my Instagram and Twitter. Don't friend me on Facebook if you're just some rando. But you know. but yeah, I'm just kind of a big deal. So that's just kind of a small update as to what's going on with that. But other than that, decent show, I thought.
Yeah, so all right. So if anyone wants to send us email, it's podcast@punctions.org. If anyone wants to run fiber optics to John's house so he can stop having Skype issues, you could do that too. So here's what I'm going to end with. So there was a 7-inch that came out last week, which featured Ancient Shapes, which is Daniel Romano of Attack and Black's current punk side project, and D-Boy, which is a 3-piece band that is from Welland, Ontario, that is very much inspired by the cult and imagery of Turbo Negro. So D-Boy is a loud, crass, like super crass death rock band, I suppose that you could say. They have fully embraced the way that say Turbo Negro had merchandised themselves. They have a look, they have a way that their followers can dress to support the D-Boy movement. They have this whole like hilarious art project that they've put out about that mythologizes the band, and it's full of Soviet era imagery and all sorts of weirdness, and D-Boy is great fun. And their songs on this 7-inch are really, really good. They're really amped up and crazy. And just like, if you like, again, like early Turbo Negro or bands like, say, like Electric Frankenstein or that level of just like really, really dirty, loud punk rock and roll, D-Boy hits that spot. Now, I'm not going to play a song from that 7-inch because it came out last week, and actually taking a song from it feels kind of cheap because, you know, you should go buy a copy. But I'm going to play a song from D-Boy's first record, their only record, their only full length right now, which was called Prove Your Love Live in Belém. Now, Belém is not a place, and it is not a live record. It was all just a mock live record, but that was just sort of part of this band's goofy mythologizing that they're doing. So here's a song from there. It's called Fourth Wish. So this is from D-Boy's self-titled record that came out in February, but you should totally go check out the split 7-inch with Ancient Shapes on Yeah Right Records that they have out, because it's quality shit. So you should go look for that. So anyways, here's some D-Boy. We'll see you guys next week, hopefully with less audio craziness.
Boyfriend's glowing, you are just so out of reach. Love is a twist deal. Jamaica, baby. D-boys, D-girls, time has come.